I was listening to the radio. There was a concert of classical music, Schubert, and the announcer in discussing one of these pieces of music mentioned that Schubert was not really particularly interested in what happened to his music after he'd written it. His only interest was writing the music itself. He was too busy writing to think about selling it. And I was thinking that that's exactly the attitude of karma yoga. Many people, hearing about karma yoga and hearing that it's a good thing to, and it's a teaching of karma yoga to act without any kind of desire for the fruits of one's action, nishkam karma it's called in Sanskrit, that this attitude would lead to a spirit of apathy. And in fact, we find in a lot of people, among a lot of people in India, that there is a certain sense of apathy toward work, whether it's nutritional, whether it's a question of climate. But many people also have this mistaken notion that if we are to be really spiritual, we shouldn't be interested in the work that we do. And if we have to work, then perhaps to prove how spiritual we are, we at least owe it to ourselves to do our work badly. This kind of attitude is unfortunately to be found even in India. But it's very much not the teaching of karma yoga. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says specifically, no man can get out of action by not acting. We have to act. We have to act with full intensity. And Schubert gives a perfect example of how, in fact, we act better if we don't think about the fruits of our action. It's not a question of indifference to the results. It's a question of putting so much energy into this moment, into what we're doing, that we haven't time or energy left over to be, in his case, trying to sell what he was doing. Or once it's over, then it's done. It's forgotten. You're busy doing something new. Well, karma yoga is it depicts one of the basic attitudes that we need on the spiritual path. What we need to do if we want to understand life aright is to get a grasp on the right basic attitudes for our own fulfillment, which ultimately speaking means for our spiritual development. We've come into this world as a very temporary stopping place. We were in Vancouver just the other day, and we went to the planetarium, and we saw what they called a journey through the galaxy. This journey through the galaxy it tells about all the incredible display that goes on there. I mean, we think of a little drama that happens because somebody didn't make my tea right this afternoon, or somebody insulted me, or little things that come along that seem so terribly important to us at the time. But when you think of the grandness of that scale, think of the way these galaxies are formed. Think of the way that the new matter seems to be coming constantly into existence. This is one thought they have, that the nucleus of our galaxy is, instead of a black hole, a white hole, meaning that out of this energy is spewing out into new life forms, new material, new matter, and that this matter is becoming the dust that creates stars and planets. And then the black hole, which has such a condensation of matter that the gravitational field is so strong that light itself can't escape, that it pulls even light in, and so you can't even see it. It's just a black hole there in space. And they theorize that there may be many such black holes in our galaxy. And not only the way that the stars are formed and the planets, but then after some period of time, how these stars disintegrate. They've burned themselves out, and then they suddenly start to spew their matter out over space again. And the person telling the story said that our bodies, this earth, everything that we have here, has been very possibly a star that disintegrated and then reformed itself and became this planet, and this will disintegrate and reform itself and become other planets or other stars through the course of the billions of years that the universe will exist. The scientists figure that this universe will be around for about 50 billion years. The incredible vastness of it all. We've come into this thing really quite temporarily, even though that temporary thing seems rather long if you look at it from a human standpoint. I've told the story that is told in the Indian scriptures, a little bit scary, but something to think about. They describe a large lake, and they say that suppose a bird were to come to this lake once every 5,000 years and take away one drop in its beak. The length of time it would take that bird to drain the lake, that doesn't begin to describe the length of time that it takes the soul, once it has come into outward manifestation, to get out of delusion and go back to its own source again. The Indian scriptures say it takes 5 to 8 million lives to reach the human level of evolution, going up through germs and worms and plants and lower animals and finally higher animals and finally the human level. And how long it takes on the human level, it's an incredible thing when you think of the cosmic scene that we're involved here in. It's something that we're not used to, because Westerners, having finally, more or less grudgingly, begun to accept the idea of reincarnation, what they generally accept is that we've been around for maybe 2 or 3 lives instead of one. And some of them will expand it to 10 or 20 or 100. But to think of it as perhaps billions of lives is a bit beyond our scale of reckoning. It's a little hard to grasp. In this century only, we've begun to come out of the old biblical concept that the earth was formed on September 9th in the year 4003 BC. And we've come a long way since then, but it's a little hard still to grasp the immensity of this cosmic show. To give you a little bit more of an idea, man, because he has some measure of free will, not very much, but some, he is able to take over and start advancing his own spiritual development, where in the animal and lower level, there is only an automatic progression gradually from the lowest rocks and so on up through, because everything has consciousness, up through this level of man up to the Superman. But man, unfortunately, because he has free will, tends to misuse it. Where the animals can go upwards only, man can also go down. And so it is that in his constant struggling to find fulfillment and constantly going in the wrong direction, instead of seeking divine power, he'll try to become a mafia hitman or something and get power in the wrong way. Instead of trying to find divine joy, he tries to find it in drugs or something. So man goes down as well as up, and his bobbing around takes probably at least another 8 million lives. It wouldn't surprise me when you consider that they say that it takes very, very good karma to reach the point where you really begin to want to find God. Master said that it's possible to fall back to the animal level also. That normally, if you have been in a human body, once you've reached the human level, you don't fall down. But if you continue to live like an animal, then you may be cast down into an animal body, because that's the kind of consciousness you've attracted, you've developed. But you'll only stay in that body one lifetime, and then you go back to the human life again. So that it isn't as if, having gone into an animal, you stay there for a long time. But then if you keep on acting animalistic, you'll be thrown down again, only for one lifetime, then come back to a human level. However, if you keep on at it, then you may be thrown down to a very far down the scale of evolution. You may become a germ again and have to work your way all up through millions of lives to become a human being again. And this kind of scale of vastness of time and possibility of error is a scary thing until you come on the path, and then you realize that it's an incentive. it makes one think that he'd really better get with it, do something about it while he's got the discrimination to know that he should. The diseases that come, the epidemics that come into our planet, Master said there are whole galaxies which are mainly tamasic, mainly evil, and there's nothing but cannibalism and fighting, and just people are living on a very low level. And those people, if they have just continued to live extremely evil lives, they come in swarms of germs to our galaxy and become epidemics. They it's really an incredible scene when you think of it from this yogic standpoint. One has to exercise a certain amount of imagination even to accept it. But science has helped us in that way by giving us a universe, showing us a universe that is so far beyond the imaginations of expectancy, as Master put it, describing samadhi, that had anybody from our century, if he were able to go in a time machine back to the early days of science, let's say, or back to the medieval times. Well, in the medieval times, they were ready for anything. But let's say to talk to the people who were believing in science back in the 1600s and describe to them things like black holes and relativity and the absoluteness of the speed of light and so on, they'd probably lock us up. It just, the possibility even of television and so on, they'd figure it was either nonsense or black magic or something. So science has shown us a world that far exceeds anything that we could erect with just the imagination born of our daily existence. And similarly, spiritual truth. Those who have gone into the spiritual world and lived in that world have discovered realities which they corroborate with one another. It's not as if each one were sort of inventing something or making some unique discovery. Those who have gone into this world all see the same basic truths. But the vastness of it is on the one hand scary, on the other hand, it helps us to understand what we're really here for and what we should do about it. The goal of reincarnation is not to keep on in that same line, going on and on for God knows how much longer. The story of Milarepa, Tibet's greatest yogi, is a fascinating one in this respect. He was born with a great deal of spiritual karma. But his mother was very angry at relatives of hers who had cheated her out of her inheritance and him and his family out of their inheritance. And she demanded that he learn black magic in order, because they were powerless, they had no money, and the clan was big. But if he learned, she figured if he could learn black magic, that he would be able to destroy them. And so out of filial piety, he went out and learned techniques for destroying them, which he did. He killed the whole group off, materializing scorpions and so on in the house, and they all got killed. And Milarepa, after this, suddenly realized what a sin he had committed and how he would have to suffer for a long time for having committed such a sin. And it came to him how terribly insecure life is, as long as we are living in the ego, as long as we are living in ignorance, that he made this mistake without really realizing it was a mistake until afterwards. That he could make any number of further mistakes, and he was desperate to not only find enlightenment, but to find it in this lifetime while he still had this incentive to drive him toward that perfection. He went off into the mountains and he spent many, many years meditating and became a very great and an enlightened yogi. But this is the fear that any man of wisdom and any man with an understanding of how fragile our discrimination and our understanding is, the fear that we could make a mistake that could cost us a long time. One time I said to Yogananda, Because Norman Paulson was having visions of being with Master back 80,000 years ago. And I thought, my God, even after meeting your guru, it's going to take that long? And I said, Master, have I been your disciple for thousands of years? And he said, it's been a long time, that's all I'll say. I said, well, sir, is this true for everybody? I didn't want to be the last man in the pack. And he said, yes. He said, desires for this thing and that thing take them away many times. Well, and I know, he said to different disciples, he said to Cuaron, that I lost sight of you for several lives, but now you're with me again, I'll never lose you again. But it's a very, there's an aspect of the spiritual path that can cause fear and should cause fear. There's a certain amount of fear that is not negative thinking. To be afraid of a wolf pack outside to the extent of going and locking the door is only common sense. And to exercise positive thinking and say, oh no, they'll like me, is to overlook the fact that they might like you in the wrong way. We just have to be realistic. And positive thinking, as I've often said, is very different from wishful thinking. Wishful thinking, as the illustration I've often used, is a general invading a foreign country with 10 soldiers hoping that the enemy will be asleep. You have to understand the strength of the enemy so that you can cope with it and do something about it. And to realize what could go wrong in this world with us. The insecurity that we live in our potential for delusion is really, literally infinite. And so while we have this understanding of what we really want, we should be putting forth all effort to achieve that goal. It's a great, great blessing to know that you want truth, to know that you want to come out of delusion and to find God. When God created this universe, He created it in duality. That one spirit, in order to manifest itself outwardly in creation, had to take on an appearance. The only way it could do so was by dividing its one consciousness into an appearance of polarity. Those two poles finally dissolve and become neutralized and then cease to exist. But He created this polarity, this oppositional pole, that is positive and negative and male and female and light and dark and all the various opposites that we find in this world. The universe couldn't exist without it. It's sort of like if you have an ocean that is completely calm and you want to make it into waves, every wave that goes upward has to produce a corresponding trough, doesn't it? You can't change the level of the ocean by producing a wave. The ocean level, the mean level, remains the same. And so there has to be some compensating trough for every rise in the ocean. The same thing with this delusion. There has to be, in this world of creation, which doesn't exist except in thought, it's real as a thought. It is not real as it appears to be. Matter is not matter. Matter is really energy. Energy is not energy. Energy is really thoughts, and thoughts are not thoughts, they are really consciousness. Everything is a manifestation of that one undivided consciousness of the infinite bliss of spirit. Now then, this oppositional state means that for every plus, there will be a minus. For every good experience, there will be a bad experience. Everything that you experience in an outward way is going to create some kind of opposite experience also in an outward way. When you have a good time and revel in that good time, then you will also have an equally bad time, equally opposite bad time. It's inevitable. It happens to be a law, and we can't get away from it. And if you will look at it, then you will see in your own life, particularly if you can get rid of what Master used to call the thwarting cross currents of ego. That is to say, if you've got waves going upward, but many waves going, it may be just the moment when that wave is about to come down again when another wave comes to push it up still higher. and that wave's just about to come down, and another wave comes in another direction and pushes it up again. And so the ego, when it has many different desires, you're just about to experience the opposite, I was going to say suffer, that's not the word, experience the opposite of either a positive or a negative thing, and suddenly some other desire or some other karma comes up and pushes you into a totally different space, so that it balances out very slowly and many times over a long period of time. Where the devotee, or a person whose ego has become pretty well calmed down, so that he doesn't have a great many desires, then he finds that any time he has any kind of experience, very quickly the opposite comes. When he does something, when he has a party, very quickly he will have some kind of a feeling of opposite. Well, more and more then, the person who comes into this experience, this clarity, begins to discover that there is no way of coming out on top by trying to do the very thing that everybody's trying to do in this world. Everybody is looking for an escape from failure and to achieve success, an escape from suffering and to achieve happiness, but they all define their happiness and their success and everything in a completely outward way. Every time there is any one, there is also always going to be this opposite. And so it's such a supreme irony that the soul begins to sort of tune into over a period of time, where the sum total of all the striving that we ever go through these millions and maybe billions of lives, is zero. Isn't it fun to think that we have to work for all that, for nothing, literally? It really is worth meditating on that thought. Here we are. Maybe, and very probably, we have been around for maybe trillions of years, billions of years. It's entirely probable that in this great drama of creation, with the God manifesting the whole universe and then withdrawing everything back into himself again, what are known as the days and nights of Brahma, these things take trillions of years. And it's very probable that we've been through more than one. It's very probable that we have been through many trillions of years of this particular ego. When we come onto the path finally, then we come to understand that the real goal is freedom. We cannot find what we're looking for if we are trying to find it outwardly. We can find it in ourselves. We can find it if we can get rid of this thought of personal involvement in what it is that we are doing. That it isn't terribly important what we do. It doesn't really matter. There isn't anything that man can do that in the cosmic scheme of things is important. We have come into this world for only one purpose, and that purpose is to achieve a recognition, a remembrance. As Patanjali puts it, smriti, memory, to remember who and what you are is the whole goal of the spiritual path. You don't achieve anything. It isn't as if you had, you know, when we work in the world, we think that we're going to be achieving popularity, achieving fame, achieving wealth, achieving this thing or that thing. We don't achieve on the spiritual path, really. What we do is remember that that's what we have always been. We have come from eternity. We have come from infinity. And someday, when we can weed out all these thwarting cross-currents of ego, then we will discover that that's the only thing that is real to us, that that is what we are. It's hard to believe right now. Hard to believe it when we think of this body and all its present needs. Hard to imagine that these realities that have been built up in our minds are so real, are actually nothing. But the very body that you are in was at one time nothing but galactic gases, and again will become nothing but galactic gases, has been the the tremendous radiations coming out of a star, and we'll go back into that star again. And the same thing with your consciousness. Our consciousness is a part of that infinite. It has come into this little tiny point in space, and then finally someday it will dissolve outward and become that infinite space again. So to act without desire for the fruits of action on a spiritual level is seen to be the only possible attitude, not to take too seriously anything that we do. But that does not mean to be irresponsible. That does not mean to act in such a way as to be slovenly or whatever. We have to learn how to deal, and this is the marvelous intricacy of the universe that we have to take part in too. God created stars, and he created people, and he created worms. He created all kinds. When you meditate on the infinity of the different vortices of reality that exist, and how very real each one seems in its own context, the reality of the scientists, the reality of the poets, the reality of the businessman, the banker, the housewife, the school teacher, all these realities are very coherent in themselves. It's incredible to see. And what we need to do is to learn to relate to whatever level of reality we are in at the time. We have to understand that God is really the doer of this whole show. He's the artist behind the scenes, the director of this great play. And we've got to accept our part and accept this particular scene that we're in as his show, not as something absolutely unreal, but to spiritualize it rather than deny it. So that is to say that we should act without any involvement personally in the thought that it's God's drama, not ours. It's really not our responsibility. I should think that soldiers on the battlefield, it must be a little difficult for them. After all, you want to know if you win or lose, don't you? But here they die. How do they find out? Maybe they're shown. Maybe that desire is fulfilled. But at the same time, it does seem a bit unfair that they couldn't just be removed from the game and kept on the sidelines so that they could see how the whole thing turned out. The drama of this world is not our drama. We don't really have a right to the fruits of our action. We don't have a right to anything except to express in as perfect, as free, and as joyous a way as possible that divine inspiration. This is his show, and we should act without desire for our fruits, but at the same time, because it's his show, and if we want to please him, we should try to act as well as we possibly can. We should try to act to do as good a job as we possibly can without involving ourselves egotistically, to do as good a job as we possibly can to please him, and not to please other people or to please our own egos. To please other people is impossible anyway. As many people as will be for you will be against you. The more you have for you, the more you'll have against you. It's just the way of the world. Outwardly, it just can't work. The only way to really not displease people is to do nothing, and that'll probably please them also. But the way really to please anybody is to please God. Action without desire for the fruits of action. If we can act in this way, then we come to understand the next thing, which is that technique, outward expression, what we do outwardly is not really the issue. It's what we express in our action. Walking down the street can be a sermon. The lightest thing that you do, the way that you speak, everything that you do has a particular vibration of consciousness. It's a vehicle for consciousness. Everything that we do expresses what we are. Emerson said, "What you are, speak so loudly I can't hear what you say." It isn't...
I could be talking about peace here today and telling you all to be peaceful and love your brothers and forgive your enemies and be humble.
And I don't think it would really impress people, except in the wrong way. We have to understand the opposite is true, too. That in doing nothing, in a way, you can accomplish a great deal if you do nothing in the right way. I remember one saint I met in India, and he told me his specialty was doing nothing. But in fact, it wasn't quite true. He was teaching people all the time, and he was a strange fellow, sort of a slightly mad in a spiritual way. But, I mean, you never knew what he was talking about. But still, there was a vibration of joy and sweetness that made him a delight to be around. So that even after I'd gotten through a whole lecture on his part, trying to tell me this thing and that thing, and I hadn't the foggiest idea from start to finish what he was speaking, all in English too, mind you, still I felt good being with him. The vibration is the most important thing of all. Not the form. Don't be what Jesus called a whited sepulcher. Just whitewash a tomb and call it pretty. It's still got death in it. It's not life. What we need to be is always trying to express the divine. And that's the other side of this teaching of Karma Yoga, which will help us to get out of delusion and into freedom from this great reincarnational cycle. The first thing is to act in such a way that you achieve more and more freedom. You act when you don't involve your ego. You act when you don't think, I want this, I want to do that, I want to do that, but just allow it to be a divine flow. Do your best and leave the results to God. You'll do far better if you act in that way. Just like Schubert, he was one of the most marvelous composers. The more one gets into his music, the more exquisite it sounds. And any person who's really successful in life, you'll find that he basically has that attitude. He's not worried about what the results are going to be. He's worried more about the energy that he is putting out. But the fact is that if you put out the right kind of energy, somehow it'll work anyway. Many of the most successful people in the world never got out of grade school. Don't know an awful lot of the facts involved, even in their own business many times. There is a certain flow that you can get into that will give you an insight, an energy that will attract the opportunities and the knowledge that will make it possible to achieve the right results without getting a handle on all the facts possible. Those people who build, those people who create, those people who write symphonies and novels that are great and not... I picked up a book of Tolstoy's stories. He's considered perhaps the greatest novelist who ever lived. And I just picked up a book of short stories of his, and I read about a paragraph. And it was translated, and it was good English, but it was not marvelous English. Yet you could feel instantly that this was a really great writer. Just the vibration, somehow the consciousness that came through, somehow the subtlety of his awareness of human psychology and its intricacies, his understanding from a higher level rather than a lower level of machination. All of this is a vibration more than anything else. He was a man who gave up everything and ended up just a sort of a wandering sadhu. He wasn't attached to what he was doing. All people who accomplish anything, really it's their consciousness that they're putting into it. It isn't that you could learn the techniques of grammar and expect to be anywhere near what Tolstoy was as a writer, or as if you could expect to learn the techniques of psychology and write about them in such an understanding way as to compare with his marvelous little quick insights that he gives just constantly through his whole thing, mainly from knowing himself as well as he did. When you know yourself, you know everybody. When you know one little truth, you know all truth. Because every bit of reality is an expression of the totality, an expression of that which gave birth to everything. And so it is that this this energy that a person can generate is really what determines how successful a person is going to be. Yes, you do begin to pick up the rules as you go along, and you do need to know those rules as you go along. But they will come almost automatically in their own time. And necessarily you've got to know the techniques of your trade. But at the same time, the thing that really determines what you will be able to accomplish is energy. It's putting the energy out to serve people, putting the energy out above all to serve God. And this is the next aspect then of it. The first is that freedom, which is really responsible for success. Not to think too much in terms of what could go wrong and all the facts and so on. Just know that that energy is there. And the second thing is know from where that energy comes. When, this is an illustration I often use too, when you've got a guitar, you've got a sounding board under the strings that gives them power. And if you only had the strings strung between two points, but with no sounding board, it would give a very thin tone. So it is that if we act with our egos out of attunement with the great symphony of life and with God, then we find that we have less power. People who are a part of a big organization have a certain power just because they're a part of that organization, but it's of the world. Those who are in tune with God, even though they don't know the rules of the world, somehow they are prevented from making disastrous mistakes and they come through. The divine is always there supporting them. Remember that story of the Gita, Krishna, not taking part in the battle, and yet because he was present on the side of the Pandavas, his very presence there ensured their ultimate success. So karma yoga has this other aspect to it too. First of all, nishkam karma, which is to say action without desire for the fruits of action, and the other is this consciousness of being an instrument for a higher power to flow through you. Now when you can act in that way, that is when you can act in the best possible way. There is a beautiful poem that Master wrote. If I remember, I'll read it tomorrow morning at the service. I was made for thee alone, and I was made for dropping flowers of devotion gently at thy feet on the altar of the morning. My hands were made to serve thee willingly. My feet were made to seek thy temples everywhere. My voice was made to sing thy praises, and so on. I forget the words now. I used to recite it every morning in my meditations. But it's so beautiful to think that my body is really an instrument for the divine. We should try to live that way. Now, how do we live that way? There are some people who sort of put on an act that when they're with people who expect them to be holy, suddenly they're like this. Somebody told me in Vancouver that one of the leading spiritual teachers in this country, I won't say his name, but he was at a conference and he was in his own room, and this man came into the room to ask him a question, and he saw him sitting in his chair like this reading the newspaper. As soon as he opened the door and looked in, this kind of thing where you feel you've got to put on a show for the great unwashed or something, such people will also not treat those who are closest to them as respectfully as they will those who are far away. They will treat the stranger with respect, but they will talk insultingly or slightingly or in a false kind of familiarity that betrays a lack of an endeavor to support and help people to grow with their own dearest. When people can learn to have as much respect for their own wives and husbands and those who live in the same house and share the same bed as they show for the veriest stranger, then you can say they're developing something good, something really spiritual in their understanding. Because we should be at all times trying to think of God and not trying to express Him in a matter of showing God to people, but just in the thought of Him, allowing that consciousness to come forth, trying to feel the energy, not to not to say, well, I should look in a certain way or act in a certain way, so much as to try to bring that energy, that consciousness outward to manifest that consciousness. We have to try to express it. We have to learn to behave. That is to say, we have to learn to relate to every reality on its own level. Many men, for example, will never tell their wives, I love you, because they're not demonstrative, but they figure the wife should know it anyway. Well, ask any woman and she'll tell you that she likes to hear it sometimes. In fact, we all like to hear it sometimes. And the truth of it is that we should try to say these things sometimes, but as an expression of the divine, not in an insincere way. Try to express God in your work. This is what I'm trying to do in my life, in writing books in different fields of interest, like astrology. I'm not an astrologer, or philosophy, and so on. I'm not personally into a lot of those things, but I'm into it enough to well, this will make you laugh to write a book about it. But the main thing I really mean is I'm into it enough to understand it if I attune myself with God. The astrology book, for instance, is one of the best-selling astrology books in the market now, I'm told. I don't know. But the reason is that I didn't learn the rules of astrology. I meditated and let God guide me. And so what I did was, on a deeper level, a manifestation of that truth. But the main thing that I'm trying to do is reach people in different lines of interest and show how that divine, express that divine in these different ways to give people the idea of how to spiritualize different activities, how to spiritualize an ordinary life as we're doing here in our community, not just a monastery, but a family, business, school, all these things, to try to spiritualize them, not to change them and make them absolutely world abnegating. And so it is that in all our lives we should try to bring God into outward manifestation. These two attitudes will help us to get off the reincarnational wheel. To love God is the most important thing of all. These are the ways we should act in order to disentangle our egos from the meshes of this world. It's so difficult to do, and it's so, every time you think you've gotten yourself under control in one line, you find the disease breaking out somewhere else. It's like a fire. I know here at Ananda years ago, we had a little fire that they put out. And about 2 weeks later, suddenly, another fire broke out about 20 yards away from where this fire had been. It turned out that despite all our efforts, some little root had maintained that spark, and that fire had been traveling underground for 2 weeks until finally it found a place where it could come out again. So it is with this delusion. It's never ending. You'll never get out of it if you only work on that level. But the more you can try to disentangle the ego, and then the next thing is to try to unite your consciousness to that reality, to God. The more we love God, to know a lot is endless. When you think of the vastness of this universe, this little brain couldn't hold it. I think that Conan Doyle had a point in that story of Sherlock Holmes, where when Watson first met him, he mentioned something to the effect that the sun goes around the earth, or the sun is a certain distance from the earth, or something. And Sherlock Holmes didn't know it. And Watson was so amazed that he knew so much and didn't know this. And Sherlock Holmes said that the mind is like an attic. It won't hold more than a certain amount. And most people fill their attic with so much furniture they can't move around in it. A wise person understands that he only will burden his mind with that kind of information which will be useful to him in the particular work that he has chosen or the particular life that he has chosen to live. And all sorts of extraneous information is just like extra furniture that is just in the way and will never be used. So he said, now that I have learnt that the world goes around the sun, I will endeavor to forget it as quickly as possible, because it is not what information that I need in my work. Well, our brain can't hold all that much. We try to learn so much. People get intellectual and think that they can read and keep abreast of all new information the more they read. Yet there are thousands of books published every week. The information available is incredible. Doctors nowadays find they can't possibly keep up with new discoveries in the medical field. The more they know, the less they are able to clear the way so that they can use the little bit of information that they really have digested. There's only one way you can achieve absolute knowledge, and that's by striving to know Him, who in the knowing can take you around and introduce you to everything. Like that samadhi that Master had years ago, where Divine Mother took him around the universe and showed him how it was all working. And it was a samadhi in which she spoke through his voice. And in fact, his voice became like a woman's voice at that time. And Divine Mother was saying things to him, and then he would speak in his own voice, a very strange samadhi. And he was laughing. He said, "Oh, now I see how you do it all." But this is the way. Let God show you, because you can't really become omniscient even in the smallest things in this mind, in this body. So really, I kind of like people who aren't interested in becoming very intellectually knowledgeable, who are interested in just knowing that they love God. This is the greatest wisdom of all. That wisdom, you know, there is this one Saint Joseph of Cupertino, I believe it was, who was singularly inept. He was thrown out of many monasteries because he couldn't do anything right somehow. But he had tremendous love for God. And finally, it turned out that he developed a kind of divine ineptitude as opposed to his previous bumbling. And he disqualified himself from being able to serve dishes in the dining room because he had, as Yogananda in a footnote in the autobiography of a yogi describes, or did describe in a former edition, he was disqualified by the unique inability to keep his feet on the ground. He would be passing out the dishes and go into ecstasy and suddenly levitate. And the ineptitude on a worldly level may mean divine aptitude. So if you can try to remember that the greatest wisdom of all is that love of God, and that's why with karma yoga we need also to practice bhakti yoga. A lot of people in this country sort of sneer at the idea of devotion. They think of it as maudlin sentimentalism, which in some cases it can be, but real devotion is not that. Real devotion, real feeling, real depth of feeling is always something inside. You know, there can be no depth when it's outward. We were talking about this up there on Bowen Island outside Vancouver. It reminded me of an article I wrote years ago of I described a triangle, equilateral triangle, that if you have the triangle in an ocean with a broad side at the surface, then it comes down to a point underneath. If you have a point at the surface, then the breadth is underneath. And similarly in the arts, you will find that great art is always understated. Compare great art with rock and roll and popular music, where the emotion is all outward. I mean, that's what makes it popular, because it is outward, because it can be quickly seen, because it can be related to by people whose minds are outward, who live on an emotional level, and see things only in terms of relationships of one thing to another, one person to another, and so on. But there is no depth to that kind of music, because it's all out here. And you'll notice that really great music, really great art, is always understated. It's always got its feeling held back. It isn't as if it were understated because it had nothing to say. It's as if you feel this power behind it. You'll notice this in Master's book, that it's everything he writes about is understated. He makes simple statements in such a way that you hardly notice them. You sort of take them in your stride and pass over them as if, well, sure, of course, and go on. And it's only if you have enough discrimination. A lot of people reading the autobiography hadn't any idea how great Master was. They weren't sensitive enough to feel that tremendous power behind it, that depth of joy and love, that spiritual infinity of awareness behind it. And they just got the impression, which he himself was presenting in this understated way of writing, of himself as this little humble devotee who was fortunate enough to meet a few great saints and wanted to share these experiences with us. And a lot of hippies in the last decade and the early 70s, reading this book, rushed over to India and looked up the first person who was wearing something that looked like a spiritual robe of some kind and stuck their chests out and said, "Slap me," feeling that with a slap they too would go into samadhi the way Yogananda did when some saint would slap him on the chest. But it doesn't work like that. Now people are becoming more sophisticated and they're realizing that it takes a great deal of greatness to be able to experience those states of consciousness. But that book has a very great power behind it, and only a little tip of the iceberg is shown in what he's actually said. In one little sentence you will find things that some people can spend a whole book writing about, but he's so in tune with truth that he can say it just very quickly and very lightly. Like that simple statement, "The divine sight is center everywhere, circumference nowhere." He just says it and doesn't explain it. And in reading it, you just sort of, well, okay, and you go on. But what a deep statement that is. Just think about it. That he's at the heart of every atom, center everywhere, circumference nowhere. Or that statement that truth is universally, not individually rooted. A man cannot create an idea, he can only reflect it. Our own thoughts are not our own. We are expressions of that, some level of consciousness, whichever one we tune into, but we tune into a particular level of consciousness, and that's the kind of thoughts we'll have. Again and again you'll find in great works that there is this understatement where a master will come out of samadhi, where he's witnessed the whole cosmic spectacle, and he'll come out and he'll say, "Nice." Well, what do you mean by nice? But the way he says it makes you thrill to the core of your being. The word is trivial, but the feeling behind that word is so wonderful. Master sometimes would talk about the promise of the spiritual path and of finding God, and he'll say, "You'll have a lot of fun." But the way that he said it, the consciousness with which he said it, was so attractive, so enticing, because you knew the power that it was coming from. You felt that power. When people get into that kind of devotional display where they're forever sort of being sentimental and weepy and so on, sometimes the emotion is so great that you can't withhold it. It will come out in the form of tears, but some people are just sort of maudlin. This is not devotion, and I can easily understand how intellectual people feel put off by that. But the real path of devotion is something very much inside, where you're not thinking about how you're showing it outwardly. You don't want to show it outwardly. You try to keep from it, like Saint Teresa of Avila, praying, doing everything she could to keep from levitating, because she didn't want to make a spectacle, and yet she had such an upsurge of divine devotion that she actually did levitate. But in a crowd of people, she did everything to keep it from being noticeable to other people that she was feeling so uplifted in ecstasy. This is the spirit of a real devotee. There's a story that Master told about Mira, whose husband, he said, was a very great soul, more spiritual than she. But he had made a promise to God. He said, "My love for you is so precious to me that I don't want anybody to know that I love you. And if anybody finds out, I will feel that my love has been in some way desecrated. And I won't want to live anymore. I will give up my body." He had that power to give up his body. He was a great saint. And So Mira, although she too was a very saintly woman, didn't realize how saintly he was. He was in fact more saintly than she. And so she kept praying. She thought what a worldly husband she had, and nobody ever found out anything to the contrary. But she kept praying for his conversion. And she was always singing in the streets and in the temple, and crowds of people would come and clap their hands and join them in dancing and singing God's name and so on. And her own husband seemed to be this worldly person. Until one night, she woke up, and she heard him in his sleep calling out, "Oh God, oh my beloved, oh my beloved, oh," like this. And she was so thrilled to the core of her being, because she knew then his secret. And when they woke up in the morning, she said, "I've found you out." And he said, "Please, please don't say it." She said, "Oh yes, I know what a devotee you are." And he said, "I'm sorry you said that, because I have now to keep my promise." And he sat down and went into samadhi and just left his body, and that's when he died. So it is that Master told this story to try to show the spirit of a true devotee, which is to always, it's between you and God. It's not something you make a show of to other people. It's something you express his love to other people. But there is always this corner of your heart that is something between you and him, and no one else comes into the picture there. This is real devotion. When you can build up this inner power where only a little bit of that thing shows outwardly, that kind of devotion for God, where all day long there is a part of your mind that is just saying, "I love you, I love you." Or all day long there is this constant feeling of his presence, constant feeling of... Master said that this is a very good practical teaching. He said in the background of most people's minds, there is always this this thought going on, if I had met this man, if I had met this woman, if I had accomplished this, if only I could do that. There's always this kind of a desire going on, which amounts really to a kind of mantra. Just a constant repetition of an idea. He said, if you could make that constant mental whisper a whisper to God, then you would very quickly achieve that. The laws of this world are such that you might not achieve the things that you're looking for here. Karma may prevent it. Karma works in so many strange and subtle ways. An astrologer in India told me that according to my horoscope, I would have two brothers and no sister, but one sister would die in my mother's womb. Now that seems pretty far-fetched, but I have two brothers, no sister, and I asked my mother when I came back to America if she'd ever had a miscarriage, and she said yes. According to some kind of karma I set up before I even came into this body. We don't know what kind of things we've stored up, but we can build this deep devotion to God inwardly. This is our real relationship. The world, you can't control how it's going to respond to you. You can't determine how things are going to go on in the world around you. You may work very hard and still not achieve success. It will come sooner or later, because the law of the world is that if you work hard, if you have a strong desire, that desire has to be fulfilled. But it may not be fulfilled when you want it to be. It may be fulfilled just when you don't want it to be. For example, you have worked hard to become famous, let's say, and you die in obscurity. But then you have decided, because of that obscurity, you've reached a point of wisdom where you don't want fame anymore. And in your next life, you're trying to live in a quiet, private area where you can just meditate. But you'd already developed that desire for fame. And you had perhaps also done the right kind of work that would make you karmically deserving of that fame. Well, karma doesn't say, "Oh, you changed your mind, okay, I won't give it to you." You've started it. So here you are in your cave in the Himalayan mountains, crowds clambering up the rocks trying to reach you. It'll come, and sometimes not when you want it. But this thing inwardly will come right as soon as you have that desire. It will be there. It's something that you can, this relationship between you and God is something that can be sweet all the time, Not everybody. Everybody in the world wants to be rich. Most people do. But the laws of this world are such that not everybody can be rich. It isn't possible. If everybody had $1 million, then the grocers would simply be charging us $100 for a head of lettuce. And it would amount to the same thing. That's what happens when you get into that state of consciousness. It's happened from time to time, repeatedly through history, that in fact people have ended up having millions, billions, trillions of dollars and finding that they don't have enough money to buy a loaf of bread. Because of that level of greed in human nature, where everybody wants a cut of the pie and thinks he has a right to it, like somebody during the oil crunch they had a few years ago made the absurd statement that gasoline for his car was his constitutional right. Well, we get into this idea that wealth is my constitutional right. How is the government going to make it possible? By printing enough dollars to give you all that money. And that's how inflations occur. We're going into that kind of thing now. But the world is such that you can't all be rich. But the world is also such that you can all be rich in God. All of us can have as much of God as anyone else. It's not as if everybody in the world were to meditate and go into cosmic consciousness, the cosmic consciousness would become crowded with all these souls beating, knocking about in the cosmic darkness. No, there's room for everybody, because that's the only reality that exists anyway. I used to have that sort of puzzlement. How can we all survive? How can we live in this cosmic consciousness? If everybody got there, would there be room for us? But it's not like that. You dissolve this sense of separateness and you become one with the whole thing. And so all of us could be there, and we're not sort of crossing wires. All of us can have God right here and right now. We can become infinitely rich. Why worry about these few little baubles? The story that Master tells about a hermit in the Himalayas who got the desire to built a temple there, and so he went to the Muslim Emperor Akbar to ask him if he would like to. He had heard that he was very generous. Ask him if he would like to help to build that, like to build that temple. And the emperor was in the mosque meditating, praying, rather. I guess they don't meditate. And so he went and he sat near the emperor, and the emperor was praying out loud. Lord, give me more land, give me more wealth, give me more power, give me more fame. And as he was going on in this long catalog of desires, the hermit began to laugh, and finally he was just rolling on the floor, splitting his sides with laughter. And when the prayer was over, the king looked around to see where this commotion had come from, and he said, what was so funny? And the hermit said, well, Your Majesty, I came to ask you to help me to build a temple in an area that doesn't have one and needs it. And the king said, well, I've done that. I might be very willing to do it. But what was so funny? Why were you laughing? He said, well, I came to you to ask you for a temple, and I find with you, with all your wealth, we're asking for more wealth. With all your power, we're asking for more power. With all your fame, you wanted more fame. With all your territory, you wanted more territory. And I find that I was coming to beg from a beggar. I said, I don't want to beg from a beggar. Let me beg from the one you're begging from. And so it is that in this world, we can't have it all, but we can have it from God. Let us beg from Him, but rather let's not beg from Him. Let us understand that we have a right to that. You know, the Bengali original of the song, the chant, Door of My Heart, has a stanza that Master didn't translate. He translated the two stanzas, Door of my heart, open wide, I keep for thee. Wilt thou come, if but just for once come to me? Will my days fly away without seeing thee, my Lord? Night and day, I look for thee, night and day. It's a beautiful, beautiful chant. But the other stanza that he left out said, Ami Bikiri, I'm a beggar before your throne. And Master never would allow that word beggar. He said that we're not beggars. A beggar, what does a beggar get? He comes and you may give him a penny. But your own son, your own daughter, Won't you give him everything you have? We are children of the infinite. We have a right to everything. But the thing is, we won't get everything with his body because the body can't handle everything. We can't get everything with our mind because the mind can't handle everything. But we can become everything. That's that beautiful poem of St. John of the Cross. In order to become everything, desire to be nothing. In order to own everything, desire to own nothing. In order to know everything, desire to know nothing. This attitude of infinity must be ours even now when we live in this ego, in this body, in this brain. Think of ourselves as infinite. Think of ourselves as having it as our birthright to be one with the infinite. Don't cheat yourselves of that. Don't consider yourself anything less than that infinite consciousness. So the real devotee is one who longs for that truth, who longs for that vision, that nearness of God, who gives himself to God unstintingly all the time. It's not a question of chanting this mantra or doing this dance or anything. All of those are outward things, but real devotion is something that the more you feel inwardly, the less you can express outwardly. In fact, the great devotees of history have all reached that level where they no longer did sing, they no longer did express outwardly because it became so much in themselves. And I have an interesting book it's called Women Saints of East and West, and there's a woman saint in India who lived most of her life in samadhi. She didn't come out into any kind of public work or outward teaching or anything like that. And she said, and she must have been on a level where she should remember her past life clearly, and as I recall, she said that she had been Meera, the saint that I talked about, who had spent her life dancing and singing and all great outward devotion. Meera is the one who's famous for her devotion. But this woman had reached that level of understanding that the real devotion is something deeper than that. And so she had evolved to a higher level where nobody knew she was a devotee even. Nobody knew that depth of longing that she had. Well, this is what we need to emphasize if we want to use the path of bhakti yoga to achieve this state again that we're talking about, of freedom from reincarnation, freedom from continuing involvement in the ego. How often I've seen the outwardness on the faces of people, a very interesting. If any of you have had a chance to see that book, or if you have that book, it's by Christopher Isherwood, and it's Ramakrishna and His Disciples. I believe that's the name of it. Do you have that book? There is a picture in that book of Sharadama, the wife of Ramakrishna, and Nivedita, Sister Nivedita, the Western disciple of Vivekananda, sitting facing each other. That picture will tell you more than a whole sermon on the subject. Nivedita was a very good woman. It wasn't as if she was worldly. She was a very devoted and a wonderful person, spiritual person. But you see her form of spirituality. It isn't as if you're seeing worldliness pitted against spirituality, but you're seeing her form of spirituality pitted against another form of spirituality. And you're seeing East and West. And it's a very interesting contrast. Sarvama is sitting there very, you can see in the expression of her eyes how very inward her consciousness is. And Sister Nivedita is so obviously there just taking it all in, reaching out to Sarvama, just arrived in India, and oh, this wonderful new scene here. And you see that energy going outward from her in a good way, but reaching out toward, and Sarvama just absorbing within. Look at that picture, please. It'll tell you a lot. The greatest saints of bhakti yoga also came to this state where it became a completely inward thing, where they didn't show it. I remember this one saint that I met, Sri Rama Yogi. He never talked about spiritual things. You'd think that a spiritual saint would be just sort of eagerly taking every opportunity to cram spiritual homilies down people's throats. But it isn't so at all. They're only interested in reaching people on a level, if people understand. And so he didn't usually talk to people. He said that I'm talking to you because you have good karma. But he said, you ask these people in the village, I never talk to them about anything except diet or the weather. Things that that's what they're interested in, so that's what I talk about. But you know, I was with him for 4 days, and I never saw him smile once. Never heard him laugh once. Master was so delightful because he was so, his smile was so sweet, and his laughter was so infectious that I was used to that kind of expression. And yet, as I tuned in to this saint, I found that he was so full of love and so full of joy. Just looking into his eyes, you'd feel this radiation coming from him. It was wonderful. Master told me that when he met this particular saint in India at Ramana Maharshi's ashram, that they just walked around for half an hour, hand in hand, over the ashram property, looking at things. And Master said, if I'd been, I don't know, not a half an hour, no. They walked around, spent a long time just walking around hand in hand. Master said to me, if I'd been with him another half hour, I could never have left India again. He felt such love for this saint, such God was so there. He said that he was a fully liberated soul. Very, very few masters have that state. Even the greatest masters, very few are completely liberated. To be liberated, think of it, not only to have no worldly desire, but the astral world with all its beauties, the gods, the angels, even that paradise, beautiful as it is, with flowing rainbow streams and lovely pastures, everything, just the most beautiful worldly scene that you can imagine, and then multiply it by a million. On the higher astral planes, it's just inconceivably beautiful. And yet, Master described that as just a gaudy paradise. He said that people reach that level where they're no longer interested in that kind of beauty. They're more interested in the bliss, of which that beauty is merely a reminder. And then they go to the causal world, where in his book, he says their powers are inconceivable. They can create universes. Their bliss is so close to God, and even that isn't liberation. They are capable of creating this whole galaxy. They're capable, they're really the gods behind this kind of galaxy. It isn't as if God directly created it. He created it through great souls like that. And then, to go beyond that, and have no karma of even that type, that's final liberation. So you can see how very few masters reach that level. But when you see a master like that, even with master who could laugh so joyfully, you look into his eyes and you see it's all inside. There's really nothing outside. There's nobody home. He said, I killed Yogananda long ago. No one dwells in this temple now but God. And you could look into his eyes and you saw that's what was real. There was only that inward joy, and he didn't express it outwardly very much. Sometimes it would spill over, but it was the real thing was always inside, and you'd feel it just being with him. And then the path of Jnana Yoga, and this sums up the right attitudes that the devotee needs if he is going to really achieve freedom. The path of wisdom, the path of discrimination. How many people coming onto the spiritual path with this sort of intellectual background think that they know more because they can define more, think that they know more because they can quote more, think that they know more because they've got clever minds, intelligent minds. Intelligence can become a very great trap, just as emotions can be. The feeling of the heart, if you let it spill over outwardly, can become just a maudlin emotional scene. But the intellect, the intelligence, can also become a trap if you start using it too much outwardly and start glorying in your own intelligence. It too should be put to the service of God. It should be offered up to Him. And just endlessly to see discriminatingly the patterns of this world and to learn all the laws of this world and to see how they work, it's a temptation. It's marvelous. I have to know a certain amount of this kind of thing to be able to teach, because otherwise what would I say? What is there to say? Sri Yukteswar put it beautifully when he said that there's nothing to say except God is love. And in fact, you don't even have to say that. You just have to say God. There's nothing to talk about. But I know, I've noticed that any particular field of study that I get into, as soon as I get into it, it becomes like a funnel. It spreads outward to infinity. When I was studying astrology to try to show the spiritual essence of it, because I found that people weren't getting into that, and try to show all these people who were interested in astrology to try to draw them into this focus at the center of the wheel that is their own selves. That's why I wrote that book, not merely to fascinate them. But as I got into that study to understand it, I suddenly realized that I could devote a lifetime, lifetimes, to becoming proficient at astrology. Lifetimes to becoming proficient at any one of these studies. And then what have you got? The real truth that we are looking for, we can find only in Him. So the real Jnana Yogi uses his power of discrimination only or primarily to see the pitfalls of delusion so that he won't kid himself. This is something that everybody should do. Master said that he said devotion should be kept in a state of reason, otherwise it becomes fanatical. What he was saying, in other words, is that with the person who follows the path of devotion, he should also be a little bit of a jnani yogi. He should always keep it in a state of understanding, seeing clearly. Otherwise, you'll find that you rush off and give your heart indiscriminately to wrong things, wrong people, wrong ideals, wrong ambitions. Have that discrimination that shows you and keep it in check, and the power will become much greater. In your devotion, speaking of keeping it in check, I've noticed that when that feeling of devotion in meditation becomes very strong and it spills over into the form of tears, that when that outward expression is allowed to go on, then somehow you feel emptied of that feeling afterwards. You've lost, not emptied necessarily, but somehow your devotion is a bit less for having expressed it outwardly. Whereas if you can somehow suppress it and hold it in, then you'll find it just gets deeper and deeper and more intense. And naturally it will come out in the form of tears somehow. You know that story, that song of Ram Prasad's, "Will that day come to me, Mother, when saying Tara, 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 a name for Divine Mother, my eyes will flow tears." And he's saying that it will be so intense that I will just be weeping for God. But that's only a small overflow, and the real feeling must be held in check, such that the more you can hold it in check, the deeper that feeling will become. Well, this is where discrimination is needed. The path of Jnana Yoga is that path that is always trying to see what will be the right way, and yet not to be calculating. Discrimination used wisely will not become a calculating kind of discrimination. Discrimination used wisely will be used in such a way as to support and continue this feeling of innocence, this feeling of sweetness, this feeling of surrender and dependence upon God. And a real man of wisdom will be a very childlike person too. Sri Yukteswara was childlike, completely free of any kind of motives, just completely straight, completely clear. Not outwardly expressive at all, but no complexes, no subtle currents going on underneath, all very simple in his outlook, very direct in his approach, very direct in his statement, sometimes disarmingly, sometimes even distressingly direct. But this is the consciousness of the sage, and this is the consciousness that we need to develop. Attitudes of this type are essential if we are to get off this reincarnational wheel and attain that freedom which is our true state. And if we understand, if we put forth the effort, then this knowledge of how long it can take should be a very liberating thing. It should be a goad to try hard while we have this knowledge, while we have this understanding. Because who knows what other kinds of karma are there to spin us into so many detours? Let's not let it happen. Let's give our lives to Him right now.